Chapter 40. Sore Travail. Do the children of this period dream of the spiritual mother's sore travail through the long night that has opened their eyes to the light of Christian Science? Mary Baker Eddy, 1900. While Boston officials were laboring over the translation problem, the lecturers were meeting with phenomenal success. Edward A. Kimball had lectured to an immense audience in Stephen, Minnesota, on the 23rd of September. But his lecture in Kansas City on September 30th broke all records. Back home in Chicago, he wrote of it to the leader. Chicago, Illinois, October 2nd, 1900. Dear Mother, I lectured in the Great Convention Hall in Kansas City on Sunday. This is the hall where Mr. William Jennings Bryan was nominated, and the audience was enormous. The newspapers stated that there were 10,000 people there, but the number really was 8,000. Think of that out of a population of only 175,000. You can get some idea of this audience when I tell you that it was three times as large as the seating capacity of Tremont Temple in Boston. The total capacity of the hall is 12,000. The two churches joined very harmoniously to bring this event to pass, and by doing so, have made history, because there never was such an audience assembled by Christian Scientists before. The Kansas City Star, with a circulation of 90,000, published the lecture in full. We expect to have a similar affair here next week. I am to lecture for all the churches in the Coliseum, and it is probable that there will be an audience of 10,000 people. The lecture at Kansas City was my 200th, and because you are interested in this lecture work, I will say that I never have missed an appointment, nor postponed a date. 197 of these lectures have been without rain. In the other three, the rain did not materially affect the audience, with one exception. With much love, Edward A. Kimball. The Kansas City Scientists had been concerned that their lecture could not be heard in such an enormous hall, but one of them wrote following the lecture, "The acoustic properties of the hall seemed perfect. Hundreds seated in the south balcony, fully a half block distant from the speaker, could hear every word. Toward the close of the lecture, and amid profound silence, Mr. Kimball read from Science and Health. The lame, the deaf, the dumb, the blind, into the land of Christian Science, where fetters fall." The impressiveness of this moment can scarcely be described. The vast audience leaned forward and reverently listened. Kimball's lecture in Kansas City made history, but all the Christian Science lectures were growing in popularity. In the Sentinel for September 20th, Mrs. Eddy had published this notice. "I have the pleasure of announcing to our readers, by consent of Judge Joseph R. Clarkson of Omaha, Nebraska, that he is now available as a lecturer throughout the United States and Canada. Any Church of Christ Scientist can call for his valuable services in this capacity and be supplied according to the rules regulating the Board of Lectureship." The response to this notice was immediate. Many churches, including the Mother Church, called for his services, which involved a good deal of correspondence, including this bit on the 26th of September. Beloved Mother, a few days ago, I wrote you saying that the directors had selected Judge Joseph Clarkson to give the next lecture on Christian Science for the Mother Church, and asked you if you approved of the selection. I have received no word from you on that subject. So now I ask again, thinking that it is possible my former letter may not have reached you. Will you kindly let me know if you approve of Judge Clarkson so that we may telegraph him as the time is getting short? Hastily and lovingly yours, William B. Johnson. Beloved student, this is the first time I have heard of your selection for lecturer. Yes, I highly approve of it. With love, M. B. Eddy. The semi-annual Mother Church lecture was given by Clarkson at Tremont Temple on Tuesday, October 9th, to an audience of 2,500 who turned out in a pouring rain. Another first occurred that same night in Chicago, where Mr. Kimball lectured to an audience estimated to be between 10 and 15,000. Hannah editorialized about this Chicago event. Quote, "These great gatherings to hear from the lips of our lecturers something of what Christian Science is and what it is not are among the astonishing events of this astonishing age." End quote. Far more astonishing was the work of wickedness against Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science that seemed to be going on behind the scenes. No prominent worker was untouched by it, but few were aware of this until awakened by the leader. Clarkson, unawakened to this danger, went on to lecture at Fairmont, Minnesota, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and many other locations in several states. But Clarkson was strong and dedicated. Her dear adopted son, who had not been able to withstand the malicious animal magnetism directed at his mother and her cause, was a weak link that the enemy would use as a tool. In the endeavor to prevent this, if possible, and to strengthen him, his mother wrote to him on October 28th. Dear Doctor, a few moments I give to you this calm, sweet Sunday. How good God is to us, who know so little how to be good to him. But love is divine, is always love. And in its objects, whether it be the rod or staff, it comforteth us and points the path. I have longed for time enough to say to you that I acted not in your dismissal from the Mother Church. I only assented in order to choose the least of two evils. In other words, your case coming before this church from a branch church and the charge being criminal according to law, or simply to drop your name and reject the other charge. May God bless you in all your paths in life. Make them straight and leading onward and upward. May you realize that Mother has done the best for you that she knows, even if she is not understood. Yet she is faithful. You are better to be removed from malicious animal magnetism in Boston. Affectionately, M. B. Eddy. With all the demands upon the founder's time, her primary efforts were always devoted to healing, though no longer at public request. An early student, tracing Mrs. Eddy's footsteps shortly after she left us, recorded the following. I was standing at the second flight of stairs in 385 Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, Mrs. Eddy's old home, when Mrs. Blank said to me, quote, "It was at the foot of this staircase that Mrs. Eddy raised Calvin Fry from the dead. She had called him to come downstairs, and he fell near the bottom and broke his neck, and was lying so that his head was twisted under his body. Mrs. Eddy said to him, 'Calvin, get up. Calvin, get up.' And the second or third time she said it, Mr. Fry came to life and got up on his feet." End quote. This, I believe, was the first time Mrs. Eddy raised Calvin Fry from the dead, of the three cases I have heard of. I told a student who had been with Mrs. Eddy in the early days that I knew Mrs. Eddy had raised Calvin Fry from the dead on two different occasions. She said, quote, "Oh, more than that," end quote, and then told me that one time she and Mrs. Eddy were together on the veranda, and Mrs. Eddy sent her with a message to Mr. Fry. When she reached his room, she called to him, but got no answer. Then she went in and found him on the floor. He must have been there some time. She lifted his arm, and it fell limp. She felt his hand, and it was cold. Then she called Mrs. Eddy, who came very quickly and saw his condition and great need. Through Christian Science treatment, she helped him and he returned to consciousness. Then, speaking the truth to him continually, after about an hour, he moved his head. Mrs. Eddy, standing beside him, told him to arise with her help, which he did, and then she left him. She then called him to her from time to time and spoke the truth to him very earnestly until she found he was quite well. This latter experience occurred at Pleasant View and is recorded in greater detail in Clara Shannon's Golden Memories. One day while I was writing to Mrs. Eddy's dictation, she sent me with a message to Mr. Fry, who was in his room. When I reached the door, which was open, I saw him lying on his back on the carpet, apparently lifeless. I returned to our leader and told her about it, saying, "It seems as though he has fainted." She immediately rose, and we both went to his room. She kneeled beside him and lifted his arm, which fell inert. She then began to talk to him. I had been praying for him, but what she said to him was a revelation, to which I listened in wonder. Such heavenly words and tenderness, such expression of love I had never heard, telling him the truth of man's relationship to God. After a while, he opened his eyes, and as soon as Mother saw that he was becoming conscious, her voice changed, and most severely, she rebuked the error that seemed to be attacking him. Her voice and manner were so different according to the need that I was deeply impressed. Presently she told him to rise on his feet and gave him her hand to help him to get up. Then she turned around and went out of the room, down the passage where she had been sitting, when she called out, "Calvin, come here." And he followed her. She spoke to him for several minutes, striving to wake him up, at times thundering against the error. Then she said, "Now you can go back to your room." He went from the passage towards his room, but before he entered, she called him again and talked to him, and this was repeated several times. I said, "Oh, mother, couldn't you let him sit down a few minutes?" She said, "No. If he sits down, he may not waken again. He must be aroused. We mustn't let him die. He is not quite awake yet." She began to talk to him again and reminded him of the time when Martha and Mr. Fry together drove out and spent the day there, and she began to remind him of the experiences of that day. That reached him, and she said, "You haven't forgotten, Calvin?" And he said, "No, mother," and laughed heartily. Then she talked more of the truth to him and told him he could go back to his room and this time watch. She explained to me that when you speak the truth to anyone, if the truth you speak causes him to laugh, cry, or get angry, you have reached the thought that needed correction. The next day, Clara Shannon went to Calvin and asked, "Calvin, where were you yesterday when you appeared to us to have died?" He answered, "In the pantry, eating custard pie." Miss Shannon also recorded that Calvin never referred to this experience, but that ever after, he was a changed man. Such were the time-consuming episodes of Mrs. Eddy's life, a life the world knew nothing of. The leader was never beguiled by the silent arguments of the enemy, which were constantly influencing her students, but she was obliged to be just as constant in her endeavors to awaken and instruct them to resist this influence. She had to do the same with her attorneys, who were working on the Woodbury case, which proved more difficult, for they were not Christian Scientists and had no understanding of animal magnetism. Nevertheless, near the end of October, when attorneys Streeter in Concord and Elder in Boston were contemplating an action that was directed by Mrs. Woodbury, Mrs. Eddy wrote to General Streeter, explaining this influence and expressing her opposition to their plan. Later, both agreed, sheepishly, that she was right, although they were not easily convinced, as is evident from General Streeter's response on November 1st, to Mrs. Eddy's letter. By the last statement, I infer that you think Mrs. W. has, quote, through mental silent suggestion, end quote, influenced my mind, as well as that of Mr. Elder, to show our hand, that is, file the interrogatories. And when you say, quote, "Go no further with my consent in that direction," end quote, I understand you to instruct me that I am not to see Mr. Elder on your behalf, about filing these interrogatories, and that the same are not to be filed. Is this what you really mean? If it is, I ought to advise you that you should have counsel whose mental balance cannot be influenced to mismanage your case through the mental silent suggestion of a woman like Madame Woodbury. I, as one of your counsel, am not conscious of being influenced by Mrs. W. to take any action prejudicial to the interests of the case, which I, with Mr. Elder, have been employed to defend. I know of but one way to protect your interests, and that is to deal with this plaintiff's case in the same way and by the same methods that I would deal with any plaintiff's case, in which such a vicious and selfish attack has been made on my client, as Mrs. Woodbury has made on you. Of course, General Streeter was not conscious of being influenced by mental malpractice. That was the one evil incessantly lulling mankind and keeping, quote, the world asleep in night's embrace, end quote. Mrs. Eddy's whole mission was to awaken the sleepers and, quote, break earth's stupid rest, end quote, though much of her labor was unseen and unappreciated at the time, as she stated, quote, do the children of this period dream of the spiritual mother's sore travail through the long night that has opened their eyes to the light of Christian Science? End quote. At this crucial hour, her directors in Boston needed to open their eyes to the enemy's tactics, so the leader sent them a copy of her letter to Dr. Foster Eddy. On the same day, November 8th, William B. Johnson received a telephone call, probably from Calvin Fry. The message was as follows. Mother charges you and the other directors not to name outside your meeting together what she has written in a letter now on the way to you, nor the contents of enclosed letter to Dr. Eddy. Also, show these letters to Judge Hanna with some charge, not to speak of it to anyone. This, she says, under authority of our church bylaw. Her November 8th letter to the directors read, Beloved students, enclosed find copy of my letter to Dr. Foster. I knew it was needed. W. does not mentally neglect him for witness against us. You will remember that when the charge of the doctor having been a counterfeiter was sent to the mother church or brought there by Mrs. Schonfrau, I objected to having it laid before the church, and you kindly complied and it was dropped. This is what I refer to in my letter. With love, Mother, M. B. Eddy. Oh, for the peace of a dog in my old age. Mother. What a graphic depiction of, quote, the spiritual mother's sore travail in one sentence. Her students were so easily led to magnify items of small import while overlooking the vital issues of the moment that needed their attention and with which the leader so greatly needed their help. During much of November, William B. Johnson was concerned with Mrs. Eddy's coat of arms, one small part of which bore a medal. Mr. Johnson's son, in his study of heraldry at Harvard University, had learned that medals pendant on a coat of arms do not pass from generation to generation, but belong merely to the one to whom granted. Mr. Johnson was familiar with the leader's insignia, for all her letters had a wax seal stamped with her crest. So he took it upon himself to make the correction in a new intaglio, which he sent to her along with a letter of explanation before the end of November. Her response was dated November 30th. Beloved student, your beautiful gift to me and the care you have taken to make it correct, as well as beautiful, I appreciate. Accept my thanks. You named the need of my crest at the door of my home on Commonwealth Avenue being changed. Will you ask Mr. Bates to do this for me and make my family coat of arms there like the one you have on the stamp you gave me? The crystal handle on this is exquisite. Its weight helps to make good impress. Its cutting is fine and gold band pretty. In regard to the vacancy your withdrawal occasions on the Bible Lesson Committee, I have only this to say, and you will please repeat it to the first members at your next meeting. I think you have already sufficient members on the committee, and recommend that you leave the number as it is at present. May the last of this century be to you the best, and divine love make your life forever blessed. With love, Mother, Mary Baker Eddy. In mid-November, while Mr. Johnson was involved with intaglios, the Episcopal Church of the United States held its 20th annual Congress in Providence, Rhode Island. Their opening meeting on November 13th was an attack and defense of Christian Science, which was fully reported in the Providence Journal the next day. Several pages of the November 22nd Sentinel were devoted to a report of this meeting. But even though Hannah refuted some of the attacks made, the arrangement of the Sentinel report left the impression that the overall meeting was kindly toward Christian Science, which was not the case. Hannah was totally dedicated to Mrs. Eddy and to Christian Science. He had been a great help in the past and was in a key position to assist her, but he was not giving her the help she needed at the present hour for the furtherance of the cause. No progress had been made on the Sentinel and Journal in German. In the Episcopal Congress, quote, the armaments of concealed warfare, end quote, had not been met. So the leader must meet this attack herself, which she mentioned in her letter of November 27th to Mrs. Stetson. Augusta, darling, what shall I say to a good child like you, to a Christian Scientist such as you? This, well done, good and faithful, thou shalt be made ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of doing good. Do not you feel happy in clothing her who loves you, prays for you, watches for you, waits for you to be with her here and in heaven? Yes, darling child, Mother appreciates your footsteps of the flock, whom the Great Shepherd are calling, who hear and follow, and none shall be able to pluck them out of his hands. You will hear from me soon, through the newspapers, on the Episcopal Congress. It will help you, dear one, to meet the armaments of concealed warfare. Again, darling, I say, Mother loves you and appreciates your scientific demonstration over my other students and the, quote, enter thou, end quote, that God is speaking to you. With love, thine, Mary B. Eddy. Before her response to the Episcopal Congress was published, the Boston Globe requested her sentiment on what the last Thanksgiving Day of the 19th century should signify to all mankind. Her response, Miscellany, page 264, was published in the Globe on Thursday, November 29th. Her article regarding the Episcopal Congress appeared in the Boston Herald the following Sunday, December 2nd. The Church Congress of the Episcopal Church recently convened at Providence, Rhode Island, smiled mildly on some features of Christian Science, but its arrangement of the program for the discussion of the subject was unfortunate in the interests of strict justice and fair play. The discussion was opened first with an address by Professor Theodore F. Seward of New York, author of The Brotherhood of Christian Unity, and a member of the Episcopal Church, which was able, compact, courteous, and altogether logical and ample. It was a conscientious tribute from one whose heart is manifestly full of the love of Christ and love for his fellow men, who has studied Christian Science from its spiritual standpoint with a firm belief in Christ Jesus, his example, and his teachings, and who has aimed to get to the very bottom of his subject. It is reported that he was listened to with rapt attention from its beginning to its close by an audience of 1,500 persons. His opening of the discussion gave unlimited opportunity for unbridled criticism from those who followed him without possible reply. And a lawyer who referred to Christian Science in objectionable phrase made the argument against it and made his exit from the Congress substantially uncorrected and unrebuked. As Christian Science is founded strictly on the life and teachings of Christ Jesus, it may be pertinent to ask why a doctor or a lawyer who evidently has no aggressive faith in Jesus and his life labors for humanity, and who seldom reads a chapter from the Gospels and rarely enters a Christian house of worship, should be asked to address such a Congress on such a subject. Is it not obvious that the religious side of the question, its important and vital side, would be studiously ignored? Note the addresses of Dr. William M. Polk and Mr. W. A. Purington as reported in the Providence Journal for a definite answer. Lawyer Levitt's reply to unjust criticisms against the Christian Science textbook was a spiritual sunburst on the darkness. As an interesting illustration of the lack of spirit and breadth and nobility of Mr. Purington's address, the following is quoted from it verbatim. It is only just to say that Mrs. Eddy's practice is in accord with this part of her teaching. She says there is no pain and no disease, and that she can restore decaying bones to healthy condition. Science and Health, line 16, page 359. Yet she had her teeth extracted by Dr. Fletcher of 77 North Main Street, Concord, New Hampshire, under the so-called painless method by local anesthesia, and she now wears artificial dentures made by him. The following over Dr. Fletcher's own signature is also given verbatim. The story told by the Reverend Dr. Whitaker and others, to the effect that Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy called at my office in Concord, New Hampshire, in great pain, and had a carious tooth extracted, requesting me to use a local anesthetic before extracting the tooth, is incorrect. Mrs. Eddy did call at my office and had a troublesome tooth extracted, but it was not a carious tooth, neither was she in pain at the time. She did request me to extract the tooth, allowing me to use my own painless method for extracting teeth, which I had recommended. Quote, I shall take no further notice of inquiries on this subject. Signed, John M. Fletcher. Concord, New Hampshire, November 22, 1900. End quote. I have a copy of a letter which Dr. Fletcher received in which the writer proposed a bribe of $200 if the doctor would authorize a story about Mrs. Eddy concerning this remarkable episode, such as the correspondent might dictate. But Dr. Fletcher said practically, quote, get thee behind me, Satan, end quote. The doctor is a man of repute, a native of my native state, a man that cannot be bought or sold. Those familiar with my writings know that long ago I instructed Christian Scientists not to interfere with methods of surgery. But if they should call a surgeon, to submit to his methods without discussion. Those who are unfamiliar with them or misconstrue them should hesitate to criticize without personal knowledge. The following is extracted from the Christian Science textbook, page 400, and has been published in said book since its first issue in 1875. Quote, until the advancing age admits the efficacy and supremacy of mind, it is better to leave surgery and the adjustment of broken bones and dislocations to the fingers of a surgeon, while you confine yourself chiefly to mental reconstruction and the prevention of inflammation. End quote. I have always instructed students in Christian Science to be wise and discreet, conforming where conscience is not offended to the usages of men. The practice of surgery is not introduced into Christian Science, whose rules and methods are based upon the examples of Jesus and his followers. Bishop Berkeley and I agree that all is mind. Then, consistently with this premise, the conclusion is that if I employ a dental surgeon and he believes that the extraction of a tooth is made easier by some application or means which he employs, and I object to the employment of this means, I have turned the dentist's mental protest against myself. He thinks I must suffer because his method is interfered with. Therefore, his mental force weighs against a painless operation, whereas it should be put into the same scale as mine, thus producing a painless operation as a logical result. The balance of this lengthy article appears in the First Church of Christ Scientist and Miscellany, pages 109 to 115, under the title, The Christian Science Textbook.